Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Truth and Movies. Today, it's Shark vs. Statham in director John Turteltaub's schlocky horror, The Meg.
A living fossil.
Thought to have been extinct over 2 million years.
We're off to Paraguay for middle-aged queer drama, The Heiresses. And, as the Winona Ryder Christian Slater gem Heathers turns 30, we ask, does the extreme teen comedy still make an impression?
You inherit $5 million the same day aliens land on the Earth and say they're going to blow it up in 2 days. What do you do?
That's the stupidest question I've ever heard.
All coming up in Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Greetings and salutations. Michael Leader here. We have no Heathers in the studio today, but we do have a Hannah Woodhead of Little White Lies.
Hi.
And a Beth Webb.
Hi, Michael.
How are we doing today, guys?
I'm good. I'm raring to go. I'm
good
excited.
Good week for movies. I'm very keen to get stuck in.
Well, let's chomp on this. Up first, we have The Meg. A deep-sea research team is trapped 6 miles under the ocean, and there's only one man who can save them, Jason Statham. But what untold beasties have they uncovered at that nosebleed-inducing depth? Could they have awakened a 65-foot shark, otherwise known as a megalodon?
There's a monster outside.
What you people discovered is bigger than we ever thought possible.
How big is that thing?
It was the largest shark that ever existed.
A living fossil.
Thought to have been extinct over 2 million years.
Wrong.
It's megalodon.
He's kidding, right?
A nice bit of Jason Statham there for our morning. It's basically Jason Statham versus a massive shark. Hannah, is that what we're signing up for? Is that what we're looking forward to with this film?
I think that a lot of people are excited about this movie. I was excited about this movie. When it was announced 2 years ago, the question was, is Jason Statham going to punch a giant shark? And we're very close to finding out, you know. I don't want to ruin it for anyone with regards to that, but I think it's slightly missold. I don't think it's quite as Jason Statham versus a giant shark as it could have been.
It's certainly more Jason Statham versus giant shark than The Grey was Liam Neeson versus a pack of wolves.
Yeah, true.
This definitely delivers on that sort of schlocky Friday night takeaway pizza sort of thrills.
Absolutely.
Beth, would you agree?
Yeah, I think there was a good ratio of Statham to shark. And, you know, part of the suspense was him essentially being chased by the shark. That's some of the like meatier parts of the film. There are those kind of like by the skin of your neck moments that really give the film its kind of adrenaline.
Mm-hmm. Hannah, you're on record as being a Dwayne Johnson fan, and it feels here that Jason Statham is very much moving into a similar realm.
Michael, I have many feathers in my cap. A long held dream of mine is to have a podcast called Stayfan, where I just talk about Jason Statham.
Okay.
I'm a big fan of his. It started with the movie Crank High Voltage, and ever since then, you know, through Blitz, through Spy, which I think is an underrated comic masterpiece.
He's the best thing in Spy.
This could be a continuation of Spy. This could be one of his character's side missions, you know. You can hear him going, I punched a shark right in the face. Like,
I've ripped off my right arm and punched the shark to death with my right arm.
This is the thing, you know. I think all the ingredients were there, and the trailer for this was so great. I love, you know, they have that you know, it's all very serious, and then Bobby Darin's Beyond the Sea kicks in, and it's just like, it's great. I think they were really going for that, like you say, that kind of schlocky 90s B-movie, mm-hmm. like, but fun vibe, and I didn't necessarily get that from the actual film.
Oh, really?
Yeah, sorry, okay. I'm big enough, and then I just, it was kind of not what I was hoping it was going to be.
Oh, was it everything you were hoping for, Beth?
Because I'm not raised on such a lean diet of stone cold trash, so this is I say with the most love, I'm all for a trashy movie. I too love Crank High Voltage. You know, there's nothing better than safe in a hospital gown, kind of running through a hospital and pointing a gun at everybody, but I don't get as much of an opportunity to watch those films as I'd like to. So for me, this was just giddy, gleeful mm-hmm. entertainment at its finest. I thought, I really liked the almost kind of play-by-numbers narrative. Like, there's a, you know, it's almost like level-up script writing where, oh, but then there's something else and there's something bigger and something better at every turn. And I was there for it hugely. I mean, it's obviously a massively flawed film, but I think the more you take those flaws on the chin, the more you enjoy the film. So, you know, there may be flaws in the plot, although I do think it was a really plausible backstory.
So let's go into some of this plot. This film has more plot than probably it needs, right?
Yeah,
so,
maybe. I think they overthought it.
So there's this research facility out in the middle of the ocean that has been funded by Rainn Wilson, who plays a sort of Elon Musk bro-illionaire type figure. You know, he's got a baseball cap and trainers. And
he's kind of, called Morris. Yeah. Not a particularly hip name.
No, not really. Fine. But in this research station, which is headed up by a Chinese science team and lots of scientists, it's quite an overstuffed cast.
So many scientists.
Oh, yeah, you could have plucked a few out of there. And some of these characters really are quite reductive, which I think is one of the biggest flaws of the film.
But it's all just a big preamble for Statham coming on board as the only guy who has ever gone on a deep sea rescue mission.
Been swimming. There is a great, for those who may not know as much about Jason Statham as I do, he was an Olympic diver, and there's a great bit in the film where he goes, I don't dive anymore, which is just, like, so great. Of course, he does dive in the film, you know, that's the whole...
There wouldn't be a film,
you know, you're just waiting for him to get in the scene, fight with the shark. Yeah.
I find Statham such a fascinating figure on screen because it is just almost like the bouncer down your local nightclub has been given the keys to Hollywood.
If you consider Dwayne Johnson the kind of like eyebrow raising, like, you know, quippy charmer, I don't think Statham is anything like him.
He's just a big grin, isn't he? Grin on muscles.
You know.
One thing he can do better than anyone else, and he does it in this film, is wear form-fitting jumpers. He's got quite a wardrobe.
Oh my God, he has a great turtleneck in this movie.
There's like a charcoal grey ribbed jumper that caught my eye in particular.
And a couple of knitted sweatshirts and things.
But he does get that kind of, he gets kind of the Malcolm role in this from, you know, he's the life finds a way kind of guy, and he gives this really hilarious speech on the repercussions and you should really trust Mother Nature. And this is what happens when you meddle with her.
There's an interesting conflict right at the heart of this film, kind of linking to that theme. This is one of those big Hollywood movies that has major investment from Chinese financial backers. And you have almost two films in one here. You have this 90s, 80s throwback schlock fest where it feels that Statham, Rainn Wilson, all the other English language speaking cast members are in on the joke. They're making trash. But then you also have this Chinese thread with the head of the research facility and his daughter, who's almost sort of a love interest, and they're playing it almost sincerely, and they have these long, sincere monologues about, this is a good day for us if we survive, but it's a bad day for science because we're fighting Mother Nature. And it feels strange, like, do they know that they're in a bad movie? Or the big question about a film like this is, can you make big budget mainstream Hollywood shark movies after the cheap ass kind of Sharknados of the world, and can we trust Jason Statham to lead them after he's made fun of his image in Spy? And so who's in on the joke here?
This was my major issue with it. I think they needed to pick a lane, and they could have made it a kind of like full blown, really like self-aware and funny shark movie, or they could have tried to play it straight, and I don't think it quite does either, which is maybe why it didn't quite work for me. I think they tried to make it, oh, it's a little bit of a comment about, like, science getting involved with nature. Oh, it's a little bit funny. Oh, there's some, like, weird family dynamics going on here as well. And it was just kind of too many ideas for what should have been a very easy-going, like, summer go and watch Jason Statham punch a shark film, yeah. which is all anyone wanted from this movie. That was all they wanted. I don't think anyone was looking at this film for like some deeper meaning about the intersection of nature and scientific investment.
This is very much it. But I think what I did is just fully lent into the shark on Statham action. And maybe that's a flaw on my part, is that I just chose to ignore the bits that I didn't find particularly interesting.
Just tune it out. There are some great... I mean, the stuff they do with the Meg is great. Mm-hmm. I genuinely very entertaining. Mm-hmm. I was thinking a lot about Jaws. And, mm-hmm. you know, in Jaws, you only see the shark for 4 minutes of screen time. Right. Whereas this, you do get a fair amount of shark action.
They do lose it a lot for the biggest shark in the world with no known predators. They do seem to lose sight of it quite often, which is quite frustrating.
They spend so much time putting trackers on it, and then they're like, where's the shark?
There's a lot of jump scares. You think you'd be able to spot this shark from a mile off.
But again, I just lent into that, because I kind of think, well, that's a bit stupid that she's in a circular glass cage and it still managed to surprise her. But I was like, do you know what? It's a big shark and it's chomping down on her and Statham's going to come to the rescue and da 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 da.
It does deliver sort of big budget spectacular scenes of tension and some of the action ideas. It is almost four shark movies in one. You mentioned Jaws. There is a great set piece where the Megalodon, it's in the trailer, attacks a beach.
Oh, it's
but there's
so
also
good.
Almost deep blue sea elements of being on a research facility and then, you know, beasties being just outside the Perspex glass. But then also 47 meters down, it's learnt some things from these very low budget, restrained, enclosed shark horror films. It just tries to throw everything in at once. And also, I don't know if it's real technology, if it's sci-fi technology. They have these gliders that are sort of like Star Wars spacecraft underwater.
Yeah.
So they're just zooming around.
They're really cool.
They're really cool. And that suddenly just turns into almost the bit in a Star Wars movie where they're trying to, you know, escape from a giant space slug.
I do like Statham has a few Luke Skywalker moments where the headset comes off and he becomes very zen with himself and then does something incredibly daring. So I did enjoy those exceeding enough moments.
I think there's some joy, maybe bad taste joy, to be taken from the terrible screenplay.
Oh, the screenplay is like shockingly bad. Mm-hmm. There are some exchanges which you're just, you laugh, not because it's like, it's meant to be funny. I'm thinking of this one moment where they've achieved something and one of the characters just is like, no, and like stares right down the camera, like, but not in a kind of self-aware way, just in like this poor man is trying his best with this not very good script.
I think the supporting cast did dealt some pretty poor lines. I feel bad, like Rainn Wilson has the CV to be an incredible villain, like a real
interesting,
dislikable chap, but he's kind of dealt some pretty poor dialogue, as is Amber Rose, who apparently can't sit in a chair normally. Like, it was really, Ruby Rose just really irked me, and that every scene she had to be in, she had to be slung over something and gives like the rock and roll sign instead of the okay sign. It was a very forced kind of role for her.
There are a lot of very odd reaction shots in this. And Rainn Wilson, there's one, I think he says the word wow 3 times in a row in a scene.
Yeah, Owen Wilson
but
style. Like.
Ruby Rose is a fascinating addition. She is in Orange is the New Black. But then there was a run of films last year where she was playing the sort of sexy supporting chick or antagonistic chick in John Wick Chapter 2, the Triple X movie last year.
Oh, yeah.
And just yesterday she was announced as the new Batwoman for TV. And I don't think she's very good.
I don't
know who would put a franchise behind her.
I think she's got like off-screen charisma. Mm-hmm. She's like got a really sort of strong personality, and this doesn't translate into film for me. Like, and I've seen quite a lot of stuff with her in, and I've never been like, oh wow, yeah, she's a really compelling screen presence. I'm like excited to watch her. This one I can't blame her too much, because I don't think anyone apart from Statham has much to do.
It's a very good precocious kid.
Oh, the kid's great. Yeah, the daughter of one of the scientists is this 8-year-old called May, and she's hilarious. Like, she's like trying to get Statham and her mum together, and like she's got this whole waggly eyebrow thing going on. Like, she's hilarious. I loved her.
Again, a great wardrobe of clashing patterns. Like, every scene she's changed clothes into another ridiculous outfit.
She had light up trainers, which I had when I was about 7. Brought me right back.
She's really charming.
It's such a trope, or a, you know, from these 80s 90s movies to throw a kid in there to add some stakes or some lightness. But she's actually pretty good, I thought.
Yeah. I really liked her. You know what else was funny was that how often they lost the kid? Like, it's like, you know, if you've got a child on this like very expensive, high-tech like submarine science station, like keep an eye on the kid. Like, don't just let the kid wander off. Like, they were always surprised. Oh, the kid's gone missing again. It's like, how often does this happen? Yeah. Like, this is the thing. Like, there were so many implausible leaps that you had to make with it. But the science behind the shark thing, I mean, the whole thing is they go to the Mariana Trench, which is, I'm obsessed with the Mariana Trench, so I find it fascinating. Like, we know more about space than we know about the bottom of the ocean. How cool is that? That's so cool. And scary at the same time. And they kind of, I thought that was really interesting, what they were doing with this whole, it's almost a Pacific Rim thing, like, oh yes, the horrors are coming from the deep. And that, with climate change, what it is, kind of sounds plausible. It's like the Meg comes about because there's a brief window where it's warm enough for it to come through the water, and we're hearing about sharks coming to our waters because it's getting warmer. So I was kind of on board. I was like, okay, cool, yeah, let's go for this. Let's either make it totally ridiculous or make it very like plausible. And they just went somewhere weird in the middle.
So we're very fortunate to have Jason Statham around to dive and save us when these sharks come about.
You know, I think he really is the saving grace of this film. I think he does do the mostest, and he's a charmer. You know, he's got a kind of twinkle in his eye, and he does that kind of like, oh, I'm the only man who can save the world from this giant shark, like, thing really, really well. I'm very here for him and in this film and always.
Any final comments, Beth? I think you enjoyed this more than we did.
I absolutely did. As I say, I'm not by any shape or form calling it a perfect film, and it was heavily flawed, but I just chose to take those on the chin and kind of enjoy it for the schlocky charm and the big moments, the aerial shot of like the kids on the rubber rings and the shark underneath it. You know, I live for those moments in these films, and I wasn't disappointed.
I think just to nail down what sort of tone you should expect from this film, we should look at John Turteltaub's previous credits, which include the National Treasure series with Nicolas Cage.
Oh, of course.
Sorcerer's Apprentice with Nicolas Cage. And then back in the 90s, Cool Runnings.
Oh my goodness.
And While You Were Sleeping.
Wow.
So what an amazing career.
You know, people talk about like, name a director with like a run of three perfect films.
I think National Treasure, National Treasure, Book of Secrets, and then Sorcerer's Apprentice. There you go.
God.
Three perfect movies in a row. Anyway, let's put some scores on this. So we have In Anticipation, Enjoyment, In Retrospect. Beth, would you like to go first?
Sure. So, big fan of Statham. Not the biggest in the room, clearly, but I find him hugely entertaining. He's super self-deprecating as well, and just so willing to not take himself very seriously. And I don't mind sharks. So 3 for me. In enjoyment, 4. So just giddy, gleeful fun for me. Laughing sometimes with, mostly at the film. And then 3, as I say, undeniably flawed. Some quite reductive characters. But all in all, just like a well-crafted B-movie that I was very glad to sit through for 2 hours. Didn't feel like 2 hours either. I was really pleased with that.
Hannah?
I think it's maybe a 4 in anticipation, just because I thought, you know, this would be like a fun B movie. It looked like a film where you know exactly what you're going to get. Then it kind of slipped to a 3 in enjoyment, and I think it's probably a 2 in retrospect. I can't see a scenario where I'd watch this again. It just doesn't deliver on the kind of shock wow factor for me.
Mm-hmm.
What can I say? Not enough sharks.
Not enough.
It's my complaint with most movies.
Okay. Release the unrated extra shark cut. So for me, I think this is 2-3-2. I wasn't expecting much for this film, but actually did enjoy it. Maybe not on its own terms, but on my own terms. And I don't think I'll be rushing back to see it. If I was going to recommend it, I'd say don't pay full whack this weekend. But anyway, that was The Meg. Up next, a huge change of gear, really. We're going to a festival favourite from Paraguay, The Heiresses. Chela and Chiquita are a middle-aged couple living together in Asunción, Paraguay, in deteriorating financial circumstances, forced to sell off furniture and family heirlooms to stay afloat. One day, Chiquita is charged with fraud and sent to prison, forcing Chela to live alone and fend for herself for the first time in 30 years. So this is the first film from Paraguay I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Not a huge film history over there, I believe. And this won awards at the Berlin Film Festival. Beth, set this one up for us. What did you make of it?
Sure. So, yeah, I'm not particularly knowledgeable in like South American cinema, especially South American queer cinema. I don't think I've ever seen a film, South American queer film. So I was really, really interested to sort of get stuck into this. And what an engaging premise for a, so it's a feature debut, I understand. So yeah, I was super keen to find out more about this sector of the kind of South American sort of elderly couple, one kind of finding her feet for the first time, learning to drive. So her partner used to drive her around before she went to prison, and kind of learning to do things like that for the first time. But I found it really subdued to the point where it was quite distracting. again, just super sold on the storyline. But a lot of it takes place in this kind of gloomy setup, be it in the prison or the car. It doesn't take place across too many different occasions. And it started off really promisingly. It starts off with like a party and these women kind of singing in unison. And you get these little moments of triumph from the women individually. But yeah, I just think it was organic. It felt incredibly organic, and the women sort of wore the roles incredibly well. But I just felt it was restrained, when I'd like to have seen a little bit more electricity in there.
It's always fascinating when we have these pairings on the podcast. We go from something that's this huge, loud, blockbustery film, followed by what is such a festival-type movie. And for me, you go to a film festival and you see this very quiet, very subdued, very restrained character mood piece where nothing much really happens, at least overtly, for an hour and a half. But you come away with this great sense of a place and a person and a culture.
Yeah.
And it's really something. Hannah, you wrote the review for Little White Lies, and you focus on the performances, especially Anna Brun's tender lead performance is something to behold, you say.
Yeah, I did say that. So I saw this in Berlin when it was at the film festival, and I tell you, I saw it in the worst possible setting. It was in this converted theatre, and I was in the gods, which is not a good place to watch a film because you're kind of looking straight down at the screen. It was a bad setup, and
for such an intimate film, really.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it was a huge venue because it was like a gala screening, so the whole cast and crew were there. That was distracting for me watching it in such a kind of bad setting. But the film itself, yeah, I really, really liked it. I think Anna Brun, who plays Chella, is really magnificent. So quiet and so, as I said, restrained. She gives this very nuanced and kind of a sort of performance I haven't seen very much, where most of her character is kind of in the things she doesn't say and the thing and just watching her. So they have these sequences, and you see it a bit in the trailer, where these wealthy sort of housewives are coming round to buy the possessions from Chela and Chiquita's house. And she's just kind of watching them, like, pick over her life. And her character is so quiet. She has to be able to carry it in sort of the way she moves and the way she looks at people and the way she observes the world. And it is such a restrained performance from her. But so you get such a sense for where Chela's come from, the life she's lived, and how she's kind of changing in this new world, how she's having to step outside, which is something you get the impression she doesn't like doing very much. And we don't see a lot of films about older queer people, for a start, especially older queer women, which was really interesting. They don't really go too much into it, which I think is kind of nice as well, because they're just like, this is just a fact of life, you know.
It's very easy to almost miss that, because it's in these early scenes. They could just be sisters, they could just be friends, gal pals. But there are these little markers of intimacy, getting undressed in front of each other and little touches and glances. And that sets up almost the entire emotional tapestry of the film. It's a film that exists in little looks and moments, maybe not overt dialogue. This isn't like the mega film that's overwritten. This is a film that's so subtle. There's a key scene where a key character, which is a younger woman, comes into play. And it's an incredible shot where we see Chela sitting alone in a corridor, and out of focus in the back of a shot, just a pair of legs just come down the staircase, and we just see her just perk up slightly. And it's just that little flash of interest, curiosity, desire that speaks volumes in a film like this. It's really fascinating.
Can't see it. I think maybe I've got an issue with the cinematography. Maybe this is what it is. But they're so hell-bent on the use of shadow and the use of light, or the lack of light. I mean, I appreciate that it's the subtleties of behaviour and the subtleties of the movement and, you know, the limited dialogue, but also it's just so gloomy, for want of a better word. I find it really hard to engage with something that, you know, is so shrouded in shadow and it's so they're so determined to kind of withdraw from you that I found it really hard to engage with the story and with the characters. I mean, the performances are obviously fantastic and, you know, like little moments where they part at the prison and, you know, leaving each other for the first time in a very long time. And, you know, there's moments like that where I would have liked to have seen a little bit more, both in terms of
actually being able to see them
and visibly.
But that's the thing, it's everything seems so well considered in this film. You know, the lighting of these interiors speaks further volumes about this class structure of Paraguay, these old families that maybe in previous regimes, previous political moments were rich, now live in these dusty old houses filled with heirlooms that they don't really need anymore, old cars they've not driven in decades, pianos that are out of tune, and they're selling to a young nouveau riche generation. Reminds me of the book The Little Stranger by Sarah Waters, or The Remains of the Day, the sense of a passing of generations. And it's a very obvious way to show that by having these very dimly lit, gloomy interiors. But it shows how, you know, cooped up her life has been and how she hasn't had reasons to live for years.
And Cello is so particular as well. And this is the thing, there's a whole scene where Chiquita is telling the new maid how to like prepare her meals and things, and it's all like she has to have this and this and this and this. Like, there's a sense that everything within the house is the way it is because that's how she needs it to be. And then she steps outside, and I think outside you see the kind of more like the sunshine, and you get a sense that it is a world of contrasts for her, and that's what I really connected to. These tentative steps that she's making into the outside world, and the shots of her kind of just driving around, like almost a bit like Taxi Driver, like getting a sense of this world that she's never really felt a part of, were really like fascinating to me. And the car, I think the car is this whole MacGuffin in the film. Like, you know, she's got this car that her father gave her, and Chiquita really wants her to sell it to give her the money for prison. And Cello kind of really doesn't want to. A, it's something she feels attached to because it was a gift from her father, but also it has given her this whole lease of life, and it provides a way for her to connect with people and a way for her to have a possibility of escape. It's just such an interesting film to me about a point of view that I'm very far removed from.
And such an insight into a country I know very little of. And Marcello Martinesi, this is his first film, he has worked in the TV and film industry in Paraguay for a long time. He says he's very openly, people refer to this as being part of this South American new wave, but he says it's not a new wave in Paraguay, it's the first wave. Until 1989, there was no free creative industry because of propaganda and state control. And still now, it took him years to get this film off the ground, and it's still a struggle. He needs to find international producing partners. So it's really fascinating to watch this film and then just figure out that these films are, even when they're not overtly political, they're still a struggle to make in some cultures and industries. So let's wrap this up and put some scores on it. Beth, can we go first?
So for some of the reasons that you've just mentioned, it was a 4 for me. And, you know, obviously the attention it received in Berlin, and again, my just complete lack of knowledge of South American cinema, I was really interested to see what this had to offer. I'd say a 3 in enjoyment, purely on performance. Little else worked for me in quite that way. And then 2, it hasn't had much of a lasting effect for me. It's made me want to go and watch more South American cinema, and as you know, look into the things you've been talking about, certainly, but it's just not going to have a lasting effect to me in the way I'd hoped.
Hannah?
I mean, it was a 3 in anticipation. I say I saw this in Berlin and kind of didn't really know much about it, but it's like a 4 and a 4. It's still, I saw this, God, how many months ago, like 6 months ago now, and I'm still kind of thinking about it and still remember a lot about it, which for a film festival is sometimes a bit rare because you watch so much in such a short space of time. But this one really, it stuck with me, and I'm excited to see what Martinesi does next.
I'd 3-4-4 for me as well. I'd love to dig deeper into the South American cinema. I think this would play so well alongside the Chilean film Gloria and The Second Mother, the Brazilian film from a few years ago. These films about older women. Over here we have films like Older Women, and it's Julie Walters dancing around with a funny accent. But in South America they're really serious character pieces. And I think The Arrestors is a great addition to that tradition. It sounds like it's a recommendation from me and Hannah, less so from Beth, but that's The Heiresses. Up next, Film Club, and this week we're going to f*** you gently with a chainsaw. It's Heathers.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
So the dark teen comedy Heathers celebrates its 30th anniversary this year, and there's a new 4K restoration in cinemas this week. The film stars Winona Ryder and Christian Slater in star-making roles as two teens taking on the jocks and popular kids at their high school using some very R-rated methods. Here's a clip from the scene in which our two heroes meet.
Hello, Jason Dean.
Greetings and salutations. You a Heather?
No, I'm a Veronica. Sawyer. This may seem like a really stupid question.
There are no stupid questions.
You inherit $5 million the same day aliens land on the Earth and say they're gonna blow it up in 2 days. What do you do?
That's the stupidest question I've ever heard.
Who's that guy in the coat think he is anyways?
Bo Diddley?
Veronica's into his act, no doubt.
I don't know, probably row out to the middle of a lake somewhere, bring along a bottle of tequila, my sacks, and some Bach.
How very.
Oh, I love that clip. Christian Slater and Winona Ryder there. So it's been 30 years since this film's been released, and it's been a cult film in that time since. I guess we should assess what the damage is in the intervening years. Beth, had you seen this film before?
Yes, I had. Not recently at all, so I was really excited to come back and watch this film. I feel like Film Club does put me through the run sometimes with some of its choices, but I was super excited when I found it was Heather's. And I've read a lot about it as well. I think the think pieces have come thick and fast around this anniversary, so I've read a lot of those as well. I mean, the guts of it are still there in a way that I really love. I think the writing is so spectacular in places, as you know, as you've quipped as an introduction here. And I've seen, you know, kind of shadows of it in some of my favourite teen films. Things like Drop Dead Gorgeous from the 90s, yeah. Written by Lorna Williams. And more recently, Thoroughbreds, I really enjoyed, which was Corey Finlay's debut, which both quite cutting. But, you know, but I feel like with those films, they both managed to kind of salvage a friendship amongst the carnage, whereas Heather's is every man for themselves, every
it's very
girl
cynical,
for themselves.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. A general kind of opinion that's been had is perhaps this film wouldn't have been made in today's climate because of the subject matter, but I would...
Well, that's funny.
It's really worth discussing.
They remade Heathers as a TV show, and
they made the Heathers a sort of like
a
ethnically diverse crew in the TV series.
In the TV
they?
Series, yeah, they had a genderqueer Heather. Yeah. They had a what's the polite way of putting this? They had a
Heather of color.
They had a Heather of color who was plus size, and it was cancelled in the wake of. And now this is how bad it is. I can't remember which school shooting it was caused them to cancel Heathers, but one of them, because they felt it was insensitive to have a television show focusing on school shootings, which, you know, kind of rightly so. But the TV series was criticised. It aired internationally and it was criticised for kind of being a baby boomer's wet dream. It's basically like, oh, look at all these diverse kids. Look how bad they are. Like, you know. And I think this is why the original is always the best because it deals with it better than anything else, and updating it wouldn't work. I think it's such a product of its time, but in a great way. It's still as sharp and as cutting as it was the day it was made.
It's such an interesting product of its time because thinking about it in context, it's such a reaction against what was seen as teen movies at that point. Mm. Either the sort of slightly buttoned up politeness of John Hughes, the everybody's the same coziness, or the sort of frat house, animal house, sort of weird science comedy about boys and their erections. And this is so rejecting of that. To the point where, you know, profanity-laden screenplay, death and murder and everything.
There's such
anything
a good
goes.
Line right at the end where Winona Ryder confronts Christian Slater and they're having this face-off and she says, I've had enough of cool guys like you. And or I've had enough of cool guys. And that kind of sums it up. Mm-hmm. It's one of those rare films where it's written by a man and directed by a man, but I think it really kind of captures something about being a 17, 18-year-old girl. Mm-hmm. Just being done with it all, just being done with the politics of high school, just being done with the kind of relentless sexism and being treated like an object. And, oh, God, I just love it so much. I think it's really... I watched this for the first time when I was about 15. I've seen it, you know, kind of countless times since then. It really, to me, like, speaks to that kind of the horrible experience of being a teenager. And,
I'd love to, like, perfect the Winona Ryder eye roll. That she does carry the film in such a glorious way. And the costumes, I think, we need to touch on as well.
Oh, God,
because
they
wear them with such agency. Like, you would not see me wearing blue tights and a matching blue skirt in this day and age. But, but then I think there is also something to be said, and some of it is dated in a way that I just don't think would translate today. I actually find Christian Slater pretty awful now. Could you imagine contemporary Christian Slater? He wouldn't be endearing at all. He'd be an absolute nightmare.
Well, so hot though. Sorry.
The film has this narrative fulcrum at the end of the second act where you realise that this cool guy is actually, you know, quite toxic in his behaviour. But really now we see a kid in a trench coat bringing a gun to school and he's not cool. He's the problem.
This is it. And then the kind of, I was really quite shocked, I'd forgotten about the date rape scene and the way that Winona Ryder sort of rolls her eyes and leaves them to it. And you just think, and it's all part of the joke, you know, when one of those characters gets killed and she says, oh, his legacy's just going to be date rapes and AIDS jokes. And it really does make you cringe in a way that you thought that was the punchline. And of course it was a different time, but I just think in terms of how it's translated today, it just doesn't hold up in a way that is particularly forgiving.
One of the elements of the discourse right now, especially online discourse, is this sort of younger millennial Generation Z type kids discovering, you know, artifacts pop culture-wise from 90s and the 80s, like Friends, and saying Friends is problematic. I'd love to know what they think of Heathers, because it's such a product of that proto-Generation X disaffectedness and cynicism with the world, hating parents, hating society, hating everybody, and just being like, I'm sick of all this. There's no actual political engagement there.
It's
whereas
very
now it would be fighting to change things, I imagine.
This is why I think the remake didn't really work, because they were trying to take this kind of core of Heathers, which is just the world, and apply it to characters who were designed to kind of encompass all these millennial tropes, like, oh, they know about politics, they're in touch with their gender and their sexuality. And it's just, it kind of misses the point completely.
I think there's something to be said about how teen films are now, in that they're just, I love teen films. I wish I had these films growing up, in a way, because you've got films like Love, Simon, you've got Edge of 17,
Edge of 17 is... So I watched that for the first time this weekend. I just want to give it a shout out because it's on Netflix, I think. It's incredible. It's so good. It's
Hailee Steinfeld.
It's one of those films that kind of, I think, passed a lot of people by. Mm. It's so sad. It's a really, like, heartbreaking film about being a teenage girl in... It's kind of a nice thing to look at in comparison to Heathers, because Heathers is so kind of like biting, and Edge of 17, very funny, but also just really like gut-wrenchingly sad. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say go away and watch that if you haven't seen it. It's so good.
Well, this is it. And they're affirmative and forgiving, I think, in a way, but without sacrificing that energy or that humour that comes from the earlier films that I love as well. So, you know, Lady Bird... I mean, they cut so close to the bone in a way. Like, I used to have breakdowns to, you know, cinematic orchestra in cars. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So it's just great to have these kind of self-deprecating, but also, yeah, essentially forgiving films. And I think that's perhaps why I find Heathers to be quite shocking in a new industry of teen films that are a lot more affirmative and welcoming.
Or maybe it's similar to just watching that thing you loved when you were a teenager and being slightly disappointed that actually, oh, there are certain elements here that don't stand up. Mm. But some stuff does still play so well.
Of course.
Right?
Yeah.
And you know, not least Winona Ryder and Christian Slater, who are just arriving here fully formed as icons.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Winona Ryder, like, you know, Hollywood really did her dirty. She went through some horrible stuff and they kind of just turned their back on her. And I'm really glad she's kind of having this renaissance now where, you know, she's done Stranger Things, she's got stuff in the pipeline, because I think she's so talented. And this film is just, it's just such a marvel to watch her in it. And
every frame.
Every frame, you know, she really carries it and sells it, and I buy it all, you know. One of my favourite quotes of all time, which I related to a lot as a teenager, is you have this kind of voiceover where she's writing in her diary and she says, "Dear diary, my teenage bullshit now has a body count." She's such a kind of, like, literal in her sense, but like, God, yeah, I mean, that's being a teenager, is kind of projecting your insecurities on everyone else. And I tell you right that some of this does not necessarily aged well, but it is kind of essential viewing. To understand teen movies, I think you have to kind of look at the canon, and this is irrevocably part of the canon.
Well, yeah, it's such a good end point to that 80s teen movie wave. Like, almost, it's where the wave breaks.
Yeah.
And then you can see they're taking on board David Lynch and the elements of Blue Velvet here, and particularly the lighting choices throughout, and the colour, the use of colour. It's taking on John Waters. There's elements of Hairspray in there as well.
Oh, yeah.
But then it's such a, you can see the 90s, you know, the Generation X, and then the entirety of Winona Ryder's career, in a way, coming straight at you. You can see Reality Bites.
Mm.
You can see Edward Scissorhands, and Beetlejuice is the same year as this. It's amazing to think that she made both back to back.
Yeah.
It's really something. I've never seen this with an audience at the cinema. I've only seen it at home.
Yeah, no.
So that's what I'd like to see how well those lines play, because it's a really dense screenplay.
I highly recommend, if anyone's in London, I know they're showing it at Prince Charles Cinema, and that's always a good crowd. Mm-hmm. So get yourselves down there. I mean, I do think there's something to be said for a kind of communal watching of this, because it is, especially with an older audience who kind of might be picking it up after being a teenager and kind of, you know, I think my mum turned me on to it, who would have been the right kind of age for it when it came out. And I don't think they make them like this anymore, but that's probably a good thing.
Yeah.
You look at teen films coming out today, and I think you can kind of see the trajectory. And I think it's nice we've moved on to a place where you don't have to kind of be that angry at the world. You can find the nuance and you can learn how to work through that anger. And thank God for Winona Ryder. This is my kind of,
I think,
like,
that's something
point,
we can all,
you know,
we can all get behind. So if you do go and see Heathers this weekend, it's out on release, 4K restoration. Let us know what you think at the usual channels, at LWLies on Twitter, truthandmovies at tcolondon.com via email, or at the comments section on lwlies.com/podcast. So next week, we have another interesting triple bill. We have The Equalizer 2. Denzel Washington.
The Sequalizer.
Spoiling my puns for next week's intro.
Thank you.
Denzel Washington is back, ransacking home base for all sorts of homemade weapons, I'm sure. Then it's a Mark Cousins documentary, The Eyes of Orson Welles. And then Film Club is an Orson Welles special, his sort of tricksy pseudo-documentary, F for Fake.
So good. Yeah, I love F for Fake.
I can't wait to rewatch that.
Our works in stone, in paint, in print, are spared, some of them for a few decades or a millennium or two, but everything must finally fall in war or wear away into the ultimate and universal ash. The triumphs and the frauds, the treasures and the fakes, a fact of life. We're going to die. Be of good heart. Cry the dead artists out of the living past. Our songs will all be silenced. But what of it? Go on singing. Maybe a man's name doesn't matter all that much.
Any other business on the Little White Lies side, Hannah?
Yeah, so on Tuesday, next Tuesday, if you're around London, if you're around South London in particular, we're hosting a screening of The Miseducation of Cameron Post at Rooftop Film Club. It's our cover film for Little White Lies 76. It's a beautiful film. I've seen it twice now and still kind of rattling around my brain. Mm-hmm. I will be there doing Q&A with director Desiree Akhavan, who is, she's an absolute gem, and we'd love to see some listeners down there. It's just about sold out, but there are still some tickets left. So please do come down and watch the film and, you know, say hi if you see me. You know, it's always nice to kind of meet the people who listen to us spouting off every week.
We do also have Little White Lies events coming up at Somerset House, don't we, as part of Film 4
we
Summer
certainly
Screen,
do.
Behind the Screen.
Yeah, so from next Wednesday till the Wednesday after that, whenever that's the 15th to the 22nd, we'll be down there doing the print Tearing It Up exhibition. So we'll be taking over a room with all things Little White Lies. We're hosting some events as part of that. You can find out more on the Somerset House website, but we're also doing behind the screen events in association with Film 4. So
I have those details right here. There's the Art of Discovering Movies panel with MUBI.
Yes.
That's on the 16th of August.
Featuring our very own David Jenkins and
Kelly
Weston, who you may have heard last week on the podcast. Mm. That'll be really a really good sort of way to discover film amongst the many multitudes of streaming services out there. And then Michael and I will be down there for a very live Truth and Movies.
In the meat space, we'll be recording Truth and Movies on the 22nd.
Yeah,
and
so
further details at somersethouse.org.uk.
Yeah, get your tickets and come down and shout at us in person instead of the comment section, you know.
Maybe we can just have a chat about your Jason Statham podcast instead.
You know, if anyone wants to fund that, I'm available.
Beth, you also have an event coming up at Somerset House, don't you?
Yeah, so I co-run an outfit called the Bestial Test Fest. Also worth noting, I think every film this week has passed the Bestial Test, which was really great.
Including the Meg!
Even the Meg!
Amazing!
And
fantastic.
As does this podcast. Which is great. So yeah, I co-run a programming outfit called the Bestial Test Fest, which is an ongoing celebration of women in film. And I will be in conversation with the producer, Elizabeth Carlson, who has got the most incredible catalogue of work. She has worked on things like The Crying Game and Made in Dagenham, Carol, which is going to be playing in the courtyard after the In Conversation, and then more recently on Chesil Beach. And she's also working on a film called Colette, which is coming out with Keira Knightley. So I will be talking with her behind the screen. That's on the 15th next week, next Wednesday, so a week today.
Hardcore Carol fans should attend. And I'd like to make just a quick plug for my little side project, Ghibliotech, the Studio Ghibli podcast, which is now up and running finally after iTunes approved us. We are two episodes in, and the third episode goes up on Friday. It's about My Neighbour Totoro, and we have a very special guest, Beth Webb.
Hello.
On that podcast. That should be available wherever you get your podcasts now. We're running a pilot season of 6 episodes, diving into some of the big hits and deep cuts of the Ghibli catalogue. And go and have a listen if you like those sorts of things. Anyway, it just leaves me to say thank you to Beth Webb for joining me today.
Thank you, Michael.
And thanks as well to Hannah Woodhead.
Thank you, Michael.
I've been Michael Leader, and as always, this has been a 7 Digital production.